You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, the refugee crisis in Europe continues to spiral out of control with thousands of migrants spilling over the Greek-Macedonian border this weekend, and with the leaders of Germany and France meeting today to try and map out the way forward. I'll have that same debate here in the studio with Monocle 24 contributors Kathleen Burke and Phil Clark. Also ahead, China's economy has rarely been as turbulent as it is right now. We'll find out how the financial ripples are extended to African markets and elsewhere far afield. Then Iran and the UK are making diplomatic amends, but how does such a rapprochement work in practice? And later in the show, Sudan's president intends to visit New York this month for a UN summit. There's just one problem. He's wanted for war crimes, so should the Americans arrest him? I'll discuss those stories and more besides here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are indeed Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Phil Clark, an expert in international and particularly African politics at SOAS, also here in London. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us, as always. We start with the latest instalment of a seemingly interminable migration crisis gripping Europe. Now, following Macedonia's decision to lift a blockade of its border with Greece, thousands of migrants have crossed into Serbia on the way, they hope and one imagines, to EU countries, Germany, Sweden, the UK, and others. European leaders, including Angela Merkel and Francois Hollande, are meeting to discuss the crisis and responses to it, but with thousands fleeing from Syria in particular and other areas affected by war and various crises, will this be merely empty rhetoric? Kathleen, let me start with you, perhaps. Are solutions that people are mooting or discussing a nonsense whilst instability of the likes we're seeing in Syria and other places continues? Does it become a moot point to have these discussions? Are they empty rhetoric?
Well, the thing is, you look at what's happening. You can't just not do something. I mean, these are crises that can't be solved. So the best you can hope for is managed. And the question of managing depends on what you want. If you want people not to come in, you then stand there with submachine guns and or put up barbed wire, as Hungary is doing. If you are countries such as Germany or Italy, which are in a demographic crisis, or Portugal, who are not replacing their population, are going to be in dire straits in another 30 years as fewer and fewer people have to support the elderly population, you would probably welcome some of the immigration. I'm pretty sure that's why Germany, besides being a wonderful country, of course, but in sheer demographic terms, they can only benefit by this influx of people desperate to work hard and, you know, make a new life for themselves. I mean, how wonderful is that? So the question is, how do you manage the people into the places that want them? And if you look at Britain, you have a real problem.
Phil, let's pick up on that point then and look at how divided Europe is, you know, politically, socially, about migration broadly, and compare the reaction of some of these countries, you know, Germany in particular. It's a very striking contrast, not just to the rhetoric, but to the actual action that we see here in the UK and in other parts of Europe. How divided is, or certainly, I guess, Western Europe?
I think it tells us a lot about the different cultures of Western European states. It tells us a lot about their attitudes towards multiculturalism. It tells us a lot about their attitudes to immigration. You're talking about Western European states that have very similar economic difficulties confronting them at the moment. And yet when they're faced with this situation of mass immigration, that they react in very, very different ways. And I think Germany has taken a very enlightened approach, although even in the last few days, I think Angela Merkel has said, look, even we're almost bursting at the seams now, that there was this view, I think, a couple of weeks ago, that it was only the so-called peripheral European states that were copping the brunt of this recent wave of immigration, that it was places like Italy and Greece that were facing the most turbulent situation. But actually, Germany's taken in something like 800,000 refugees just in the last 6 or 7 months. And even Germany, with, I think, this profound sort of spirit of multiculturalism, is saying, we are also struggling. this is going to really push our policymakers to the wall. So I think, yes, on the one hand, we're seeing very, very different attitudes, but even the more enlightened, even the more liberal states are really finding it difficult to come up with a reasonable solution to this.
Kathy, let me ask you about the way we should look at this situation then. Is it a Western European crisis, or is this, should we actually look at it more as a sort of developed world problem? You know, look at it as a global issue, because presumably we're going to need global solutions to try and tackle it.
Well, trying to think, if you say, is it a global world problem? It's a problem in Europe and it's a problem in the United States. And those are massively wealthy, developed countries. It's not a global problem in Russia, for example. It's not a global problem in Australia, in the sense that they can keep people out much more easily than a lot of others. So it's a developed world problem. There's no doubt about it. And as long as the turmoil in the Middle East and in part of Africa happens, I don't see how it's going to stop. It's just been this year that's been really appalling, hasn't it? I mean, it seemed to have jacked up so much in the past 6 or 7 months. And one can only assume that I have great sympathy with the policymakers saying, look, we're trying to stem it, but the problems are back where they started. The thing is, we hope there'll be solutions, but I go back to my original comment. There aren't solutions as such, human nature being what it is. And it is very difficult to see how over the next year things, spouts can be closed, surges are going to stop, people are going to decide, well, I think we'd rather die in Syria than make the effort to get across to Italy. So this is an appalling systemic problem that I see very little chance of solving, and we can only hope we can cope. And the problem with more the people come, as Phil quite rightly said, the less people are willing to welcome. And we're going to, I suspect by Christmas, we're going to have an appalling, huge crisis.
It's interesting, Phil, Kathy mentioned Australia there. One's tempted, certainly from within Western Europe, to look across the world and try and work out, you know, are there places that give us a template for how to deal with this problem. Now, most people would probably not look to Australia. Where should we look? I mean, the USA, interesting rhetoric, even in the presidential election there about, you know, migration from Mexico and from further afield. Is there somewhere else that some of these European leaders could be looking for inspiration before they meet to discuss this problem in more detail?
Well, I would certainly hope they don't look to Australia. I think Australia's refugee and asylum seeker policy has been disastrous, and there's been some really great commentary in Australia in the last couple of weeks trying to put the refugee situation in Australia in sort of a global perspective. And in the last 30 years, Australia has had as many refugees and asylum seekers as Italy has had this year alone. Mm-hmm. So if you listen to the rhetoric in Australia, there's this massive xenophobic view. The government talks about stopping the boats and building this kind of fortress, but in actual fact, Australia has to deal with a very small number of refugees and asylum seekers. That tells us a lot more about the attitude, I think, of the government and a decent proportion of the population. I think the US and Canada have always had a fairly reasonable approach to refugee and asylum seekers. Now, you could argue that they're not dealing with the scale of migration that Europe is facing at the moment. So I think we would have to keep that in mind. But I think a lot of this goes back to notions of founding colonies. It goes back to notions of open borders and being connected to the world. And I think that the US and Canada have found a very kind of staged approach to deal with migration. They at heart see it as a positive thing. They see multiculturalism as something that brings vibrancy and creativity to society. And then they build a policy on that basis. And yes, I think that is being challenged in the current presidential debate with Mexico in mind in particular, but it's still a much more sane, a much more sensible debate than I would say much of Europe is having, and certainly Australia is having at the moment.
Sorry, Kathy, you're going to say?
It's just, I bear no brief for any country, but what America and North America and Canada have is space. I mean, there's an awful lot of Montana. There's not hardly anything in Wyoming. And look, Canada has been trying to lure people to go above, you know, the first 500 miles of its territory for a long time. So I think, while I agree that the way that it's being treated in America and in Canada, there are many good things, and this your stage point, I think, is a very good one. But I think we almost also must realize they've got wide open spaces to fill.
Yeah, Australia has that too, but hasn't quite realized that yet.
Is it also, though, Cathy, partly to do maybe with, and Phil sort of alluded to this, this sort of, you know, foundation myth? These were countries that were, whose great prosperity and whose great international success, whose empires were built, certainly in the United States case, on migration, you know, the move west. It's part of, you know, it's almost ingrained in the sort of DNA of the country. Does that play a role? There's a willingness, there's an understanding of the necessity of new blood, new people to keep things moving. Is that one of the problems that the old sort of powers, if you like, of Western Europe maybe are less in tune with?
Well, fundamentally, I suppose you're right, but to one should remember that every time there's a new an old generation gets established, such as the Irish, then when the Italians come in, the Irish are against them. The Italians here, and then the next generation, they argue against the Poles. The Poles are there; they then try to back out the Jewish immigrants from Russia. I mean, the point is that yes, in theory, people are fundamentally supportive of immigration, in practice, just not the ones that are coming after them.
Mm. Phil, maybe just finally on this, do you worry that what we're seeing from, you know, Macedonia lifting this blockade, another sort of surge in migrant numbers, one imagines that, you know, there'll be cynical elements, particularly on the right, some of these populist groups who we've already seen making hay over the last year or so. Does this play further into their hands? Does that worry you? Or do you think we have an enlightened enough media, enlightened enough political systems in certainly some of these countries to cope with those slightly sort of creeping, insidious efforts to try and exploit this for political gain?
I think the rise of right-wing parties in Europe in the last couple of years has been extremely worrying, and it's largely been because of a very difficult economic situation. It's been around tensions around integration in Europe and ideas of whether the European Union can even hold together. And then on top of that, you get these waves of migration. My real fear is that those right-wing parties are going to capitalize upon that. I mean, in a very small way, we saw that in the UK with UKIP and I think really divisive debates around immigration around the time of the last parliamentary elections. But I think the capacity for right-wing hysteria is even greater in parts of Scandinavia, for example, where, again, immigration has been an enormous issue, even in parts of France and Germany, which have tended to be more enlightened towards immigration. Again, we've seen right-wing politics on the rise there. And it's amazing to me how quickly this segues into Islamophobia. And I think it's the double whammy of that, a sort of an anti-immigrant mentality, but a deep sense of Islamophobia in many, many parts of Europe at the moment. And I think the capacity for right-wing parties to manipulate that and capitalize upon that is significant at the moment.
Well, that kind of leads us in a roundabout way to the next story I wanted to ask you about, which is the prevention of this apparent terror attack on the train from Amsterdam to Paris at the weekend with the Have a Go heroes who intervened to stop the armed man, Ayoub al-Kazani. They've been rewarded with a Légion d'honneur in France. The focus of many without France is on the ways in which these so-called soft targets like trains can be better protected in future. Cathy, I guess soft targets are soft, and that's the whole point. And there's not really anything you can do about it, otherwise they wouldn't be soft targets anymore. Is this something we need to familiarise ourselves with and almost be rather fatalistic about? It will occasionally happen. Or attempts of this character will occasionally happen.
No, that's rather how I feel about these things. If you have to commute, you have to commute, and you just hope that nothing happens. There's not a damn thing you can really do about it yourself. There are various things they have to do. There are sniffer dogs. There's a certain amount of surveillance. What appears to have helped was for the short period when troops were actually in the trains instead of just looking around on the outside. But the idea of going on a pleasure trip from, Berlin to France, while there's a regiment of foot soldiers going up and down the aisles, somehow I don't see that working for very long. No, I mean, it is difficult to see what can be done. You can perhaps have things, you know, often here in Paddington Station in London, I see there'll be soldiers and dogs and so forth now and again. But what happens at Reading Station, which there are huge, huge influx of people? You can't do it. You can't do it. You can only keep an eye on people as much as you can and just hope that nothing happens.
So you have to remain sanguine, be fairly sort of phlegmatic about it, Phil. I mean, in a way, is there almost a positive message here, which is how seldom we see, you know, a motive, a willingness to try and undertake whatever attack we think was being planned on the weekend, and the facility to prepare those acts and actually, you know, engage with them. Should we look on the bright side and say, well, this happens so seldom, it's a measure of how few people there are willing to go to those sorts of lengths?
Yeah, I think so. I think that has to be the response here, that this is an extremely rare kind of event. And it's been encouraging to see the reaction of the French government and the other relevant European governments to this episode over the weekend, to say, look, we're simply not willing to fundamentally shut down our way of life. We're not willing to overly securitize train stations. It's in fact, part of this European project. I remember in the old days of the Eurorail that, you know, if you were a young Australian sort of backpacking across Europe, you could get this wonderful ticket that allowed you to travel, you know, basically to any of 25 countries if you so wished. And again, I think it comes back to something we were talking about before, the importance of culture and a set of norms around openness and wanting the ease of movement. And if it means tolerating these kind of attacks, as rare as they may be, well, that's a price worth paying. I think the other thing that has to be said, of course, is that, you know, stopping these kind of attacks, it very rarely has much to do with the security at the end of the line. Stopping this kind of thing is about much more fundamental political and security processes. It is about intelligence gathering. It's about coordination between states. It's about a certain degree of surveillance, although much of that, I think, has gone too far in Europe as well. The idea of putting up metal detectors at European train stations really is not going to be that effective. And so I think we're right to be taking the kind of fairly balanced approach to this that most European states seem to be at the moment.
Could I just add one little cherry on the cake here, which is that it sort of reinforces one's faith in humanity, that the immediate reaction was to go do something about it and not just sit there. I think, I must confess, that gave me a warm feeling in my heart when I read that.
There was a great story I saw in one of the UK papers today, that in fact those three American soldiers were only in that carriage because the Wi-Fi connection was particularly bad in the one where they actually had their seats. So maybe we should also be thankful for Europe's continued very bad Wi-Fi on trains.
Cathy, let me just ask you this, though, about this. We sort of seem to be on the same page of this, but I mean, I guess there'll still be people who will say, well, look, it's all well and good saying we have to be sanguine and understand this can happen, but, you know, we have an expectation, which is justifiable, that our governments ensure our security, or at least seek to ensure our security at every turn. They must consider acts of terrorism, disruption, confusion. It's par for the course now. You know, do you have any sympathy for that point of view? I mean, is there a limit within which, you know, governments should remain, or do you think that, you know, it is incumbent on them to at least entertain these sorts of narratives, however unpredictable they are?
Well, it's the question of the best is the enemy of the good, in that if you want to actually have a life worth living, you would prefer not to check in every time you go down the street. I think what would have been more useful is if there were more resources given to interstate. Not control, but the police forces of four countries had this chap on their radar. Mm. Now, and there's always the talk about resources, and I understand that, but rather than perhaps more surveillance of every household, if more resources could be put into that, if that chap is, you know, more name exchange and some sense of doing something about, if you have someone whose name is on the surveillance of four separate countries, I think it's worth asking, why wasn't something done about that? Why is there no place that draws these together and says, right, watch that chap?
So a question of coordination, perhaps, beyond
Absolutely.
Anything else. Phil, just finally, it was interesting we're talking about migration and how different countries around the world are dealing with it, or failing to deal with it in some cases. Do you think that there's a bit of a playbook here, again, if we talk about, say, you know, the Western world? Are most of these governments on the same page when it comes to this sort of attack? You know, again, going back to Australia, we've seen instances of this kind of character over the last sort of 18 months or so, regrettably. Do you think people are broadly on the same page wherever in the world we go?
I don't, actually. And I was, I guess, sort of mercifully surprised that the French government have taken a fairly balanced approach over the weekend. When I first heard of this attack taking place, I feared the worst in terms of the government backlash. given issues around Islamophobia, fears for protection of the Jewish population in France, the way that Hollande responded to the Charlie Hebdo attacks, I really felt that this could lead to some sort of fundamental crackdown and sort of contravention of individual liberties. And Hollande is also being pressured by Le Pen and the Front National, and he's got the right, you know, really up against him at the moment. So I felt that all the ingredients were there for a real kind of French overreaction. So I was pleased that hasn't happened. And I think that these things get determined on a state-by-state basis. Electorates are volatile at the moment. We've seen, I think, a real rise in xenophobia. We've seen a real anti-immigrant sentiment at the popular level. And governments, whether they like it or not, are being challenged by that. And it's only when you're really tested in these kind of big moments that you find out the extent of government resolve. So I was pleased that France showed the resolve that they had in the last couple of days.
But also, I think one has to appreciate the sheer political nous of the Hollande government to divert attention away immediately to celebrating heroes, as opposed to denigrating and so forth and so on. I thought that was absolutely brilliant. Next, I wait to find out what happens to the railway workers that shot their way into their own safe place.
One sense that story could rumble and rumble on for some time. These are the insights of Kathleen Burke and Phil Clark here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. We'll be back in just a moment and we'll consider some of the ripples of China's economic meltdown. Stay tuned.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or the smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 on our robust new, upgraded and free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back with wise words from The Big Interview, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Join Monocle 24's international editors and correspondents as they touch down in a different city each week for our brilliant new travel program. Come on board for a one-stop audio guide to the most dynamic emerging cities around the world. The journey begins this week in Bamako. As well as hospitality highlights and key cultural hotspots, we'll also visit new retail spaces, sample the local food scene, and meet the design denizens that a potentially time-poor traveller can ill afford to miss. The Voyager, in association with Turkish Airlines, is now boarding.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, 22 minutes past the hour. Still with me, Phil Clark from SOAS here in London and Kathleen Burke from UCL. Let's move now to Africa via China. The Chinese economy is currently going through something of a whirlwind with stocks tumbling, a devaluation of the yuan. But with a tightly interconnected global economy, how's this affecting China's many trading partners? Africa's trade, in particular with Beijing, is valued in the hundreds of billions of dollars, which is said to be more than double the continent's trade with America. Phil, let me ask you perhaps first, are we seeing an economic situation in the near future for industries, for countries in Africa, which are very closely tied to China, that are really, you know, on the precipice because of what we're seeing in the Chinese domestic economy?
This was the kind of thing that economists have been warning about for a long time, that many African economies were over-relying on China as the kind of basis of their long-term growth. It remains to be seen just how long this crisis in China lasts. Reading some of the predictions this afternoon, some are saying, look, the Chinese economy will correct, everything will go back to normal in a couple of weeks. Others are obviously predicting a much more doomsday scenario than that. But I think that the concern in Africa is that this Chinese situation has affected some of the most volatile and most vulnerable economies that can't really afford even a tiny fluctuation. And I'm thinking here particularly of the South African economy, which has been in a bit of a dip for the last couple of years, 25 to 30% unemployment, an economy that's completely linked into commodities trading in China. That's a country that can't really afford this kind of fluctuation. The other one that's been hit very hard has been Nigeria, which was struggling because of the downturn in the oil economy. Nigeria is almost singularly reliant upon oil trade. So these are two big economies that have been very badly hit in the last couple of days. And they're also big regional powers. So when they start to struggle, most of their neighbours do as well. So it's going to be a difficult 2 or 3 weeks at least. But I guess most of these African ministers of finance are hoping that China corrects and things will go back to normal. But that's by no means guaranteed at the moment.
Kathleen, it's intriguing to me because we've had the sense of the US watching on with a degree of unease, I guess, as China has expanded broadly its economic and political influence, particularly within Africa. Do you think with the knock-on effects of this sort of Chinese turmoil measured in the trillions, perhaps, rather than the billions of dollars, there needs to be a global readjustment of what people's expectations are, of what damage it can do when these economies are maybe pegged too directly, not just to the commodities trade, but to what's happening in Beijing?
Well, you don't have, there's not a lot of choice about it, is there? I mean, it's a very much of a symbiotic relationship between China and Africa. China needs the raw materials. They've been buying land to grow food. Africa needs the investment and the infrastructure. The problem is, when this happens, there are several fairly obvious results. First of all, of course, any currency turmoil with the yuan, as with the dollar, of course, hits the emerging market currencies themselves, so that the currencies of South Africa and the rand and so forth are in danger immediately just from the currency the currency difficulties. Secondly, of course, when China devalues its currency, that means that its exports are cheaper, which means they can export to Africa and undercut African industries. It also means African industries, it's more expensive for them to export to China. So therefore, China can then withdraw its support of the industries it has there, because and go back and make its own goods in its own country. So African countries get hit several ways. They get hit, their currencies mess up, their export policies get messed up, who actually having industry and so forth in its own country without Chinese support gets messed up. So everyone must be praying desperately to whatever God they look to, that China will sort itself out. I think what that does is to underline the precarious nature of the Chinese-African economic and political relationship, because China is in worse shape than they're admitting. Their statistics are not dependable. And it's pretty well agreed that this growth rate they've been saying is not actually what's happening. So you've got a weakening China and a very weak continent, increasing dependence on China. So it's not a good story.
Phil, just finally on this, how much has this sort of Chinese wobble been factored into countries' planning? You mentioned experts have been saying, look, this could be happening, and some of the doom mongers have been saying this for some time. Presumably it's factored into the medium-term economic planning, or do you think that there has been that kind of oversight? Maybe it hasn't been.
It depends which African states we're talking about. I think Nigeria's always had a bit of a contingency plan built in, but South Africa, to a large extent, hasn't. It's because of the strikes in the platinum mines, it's become particularly reliant on coal and other key industries, with China almost 100% in mind. So South Africa doesn't seem to have a plan B here. What's also ironic, sort of terribly ironic, is that there was just an enormous Africa-China summit in Beijing, with almost all of the African finance ministers in Beijing and Shanghai doing enormous deals, both with the Chinese state and with Chinese businesses. I mean, this was literally only 5 weeks ago. And you would have to think that many of those projects that were signed off on are now at very least frozen, if not completely dispatched. So, and that was a summit that many African governments had been building up to for about 18 months. I was just in Johannesburg and Pretoria on either side of that summit and speaking to some policymakers there. And they were saying, look, this has been one of the biggest financial summits that we've had to prepare for. We've put a lot of eggs in this basket. Things that looked like a really good idea 4 or 5 weeks ago, I guess, are looking pretty ropey right now.
They are indeed. Phil and Kathy, I had so many more questions I wanted to ask you. We didn't even get on to the fate or otherwise of the president of Sudan, Omar Hassan al-Bashir, but I'm afraid the clock has beaten us. So there we must leave it. My thanks to both of you for joining us on Midori House today. Kathleen Burke and Phil Clark, my guests today on Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's programme, which was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Aidan McLaughlin and Federica Romagnello. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Josh Fennett's keeping you company with Monocle's International Playlist next up at 1900 Culture with Robert Bound coming your way. And you'll get more on the stories we've just been discussing and others of the day on The Daily at 2200. We're back at the same time tomorrow. But for this Monday edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thank you for tuning in.